Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002. It goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Bristol Foundation Housing with Elizabeth Winkler and Michael Phelps. We took a look at one of Bristol's hostels, which is threatened with closure. Plus, our weekly news review with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square in the city centre. Dialect recommends also the Bristol volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of those phone number and also contact details for Volunteering Bristol at the end of the show. So we start with you, Elizabeth. You are supporting what's going on at Bristol Foundation Housing. Tell us how you got involved.
Okay, well, I first got involved when I heard about Bristol City Council's cuts, cutting funding by 79% of Bristol Foundation Housing hostels. So these are homeless hostels for people, for vulnerable people. And it's a disturbing story because there really is a housing crisis. There's a housing crisis in the UK, and there is a housing crisis in Bristol. So it's very hard to understand why people would be, vulnerable people would be, have their homes threatened.
Well, it's probably to do with the fact that there's also pressure on the council for money as well. But tell us, whereabouts is the hostel? Give us an idea of how big it is and where is it?
Well, there are nine hostels in around Bristol, and there were more, but there was already some cuts prior to that.
So where is the Bristol Foundation Housing Hostel? Is it just one, or is it several
sites?
No,
there's nine different hostels.
Okay, but, and how many people are resident there
so
altogether?
So that's about 150 people.
Okay, so why did the council initially, and when did they start to withdraw funding and threaten to withdraw funding?
Well,
so what's the situation?
The cuts came very suddenly and without warning or notice in August, which left. So from the residents' point of view, it was just it's a shock.
Okay, so what did the council do? Did they say we are about to cut the funding, or did they just cut it off just like that?
Well, I don't know from a resident's point of view, but as far as I know, it was letters that arrived saying, sorry, mate, your funding is cut.
Okay.
We're no longer paying.
Because for most people who are in homeless hostels, in fact, for a lot of people who are claiming housing benefit too, the money goes straight, doesn't it, from the council to the landlord. That happen, does that happen in the case of Bristol Foundation Housing too? Or does it go to all of the residents get the money and then pass it on? I'm also joined by Michael Phelps, as I said at the start. Michael, maybe you can help us here.
Yes, my understanding that the council pays the housing benefit directly to Bristol Foundation Housing, the charity or the organisation that runs the hostels, and they then they have their own landlords, which obviously they, you know, there's money goes from BFH to the landlords, but obviously as residents we're not concerned with that. But yeah, we don't see the money ourselves. The money goes directly from the council.
As
to
a sort of side issue here, the government is trying to introduce this thing, universal credit, at the moment, isn't it, which is an attempt to actually reverse that procedure, to give the money to the residents, whether this is housing benefit or people in homelessness hostels, and then they are then told that you are going to have to pass that on to your landlord. But this is all happening in the background. That's actually stalled quite badly, and it doesn't look as if it's going to probably happen till the end of the year, maybe till next year, 2014 now. So give us an idea, Michael. Whereabouts do you live, and how did you end up there?
My hostel's in North Street, Bedminster. Excuse me, I've been there for nearly 2 years now, and just over 2 years ago, one thing I will say, though, they're not just homeless hostels. They're people with various support needs, And so the reason why I was able to secure a place was just over 2 years ago, I ended up going through quite a severe breakdown, emotional and mental health breakdown, which left me hospitalized for 6 weeks. During that 6 weeks period, I lost my job and therefore lost my rented accommodation.
Can I ask you what work you were doing when that happened?
I was an IT support technician.
And was it related, your whole personal situation, to work, or was it a situation outside work?
No, it was outside. I was quite happy in work, I must say.
Okay.
But various personal things sort of built up. And it's been an ongoing thing.
And tell us how you came to end up at Bristol Foundation Housing. Was it something which was fairly immediate? You came straight from hospital to there? Was it an easy process?
It was relatively easy, yes. Well, basically, I'd been discharged from the hospital to no fixed address, and BFH was basically recommended to me. To be honest, I can't remember exactly by whom, but I contacted the office, explained the situation. One of the first questions they asked me is, they said, "Do you consider yourself to have support needs?" And I said, "At the moment, very much so, definitely." And I explained the situation. They said, "Right, well, come in to see us." That was quite late in the afternoon, if I recall. They said, "Come in and see us the following morning," which I did. Their offices are in Hamilton House in Stokes Croft. And I had about an hour's interview with various people, various staff and administrators in the office. And within another day, they'd secured a place for me. I was lucky enough at the time to be able to, I think, sofa surf is the technical term, with a friend. But they were great and able to source a room for me so soon.
Well, thanks, Michael, for sharing all that personal stuff with us there. Elizabeth, this sounds like a really important service that's being provided. I mean, how can Bristol City Council excuse the idea of cutting off funding? Because when we've got vulnerable people there who may possibly, if funding is cut, may have nowhere. I mean, we've just heard about Michael having to sofa surf. Sometimes people end up on the streets, don't they?
Absolutely, yes. And what's unusual about Bristol Foundation Housing is that it can take people quickly. There aren't waiting lists, and there isn't a whole kind of process of paperwork to go through.
Well, that's amazing, because in most of the rest of the world, apart from with Bristol Foundation Housing, it seems that the housing provision is absolutely crammed. It's a bit like a badly run hospital where every single bed is full, and if you need a service, there's just simply nothing there. So how does Bristol Foundation Housing manage to provide a service which does actually have a little bit of wriggle room, so someone like Michael shows up, that there is somewhere for them to stay?
Well, that's definitely the mission of Bristol. That's the vision of Bristol Foundation Housing, to be able to help people in a practical way as soon as possible, and not put them through the sort of paperwork Kafka-esque nightmare of that many people have to go through.
But how do they manage it? Because there's such a demand on housing, isn't there?
Well, it's an interesting story, because the landlords, if you like, the story really starts with a philanthropist, Social Landlords, which is a guy called Martin Connolly, and he, in the 80s, he realised there was a problem in the 80s. It was the time of the Thatcher's cuts, and he found it a very difficult time, because greed was lauded.
Well, I can remember the 1980s. I'm that old, I'm afraid. And I can remember seeing for the first time, how old would I have been? I suppose in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s, for the first time on Britain's streets, homeless people begging for the first time. Up until then, I mean, we had Stella Clark on this show last week, who she was a former governor of the BBC and also a social housing provider for many years. And she said, when she finished doing that in the 1970s, she was rather chuffed, because there was no waiting list at all in this country, or certainly in the area that she was working. They had managed to house everybody. In the 1980s, we started to see that being reversed, didn't we?
Absolutely. And I remember that too, because I remember that prior to that, the people that you might see were a particular type of... It was unusual to see, and it was a sort of... I suppose it was the stereotypical bag person type, you know, the traveller gentleman, if you like, who had possibly even chosen to...
A tramp, you're talking about, of figure.
Yeah, I guess so, yes, to use that sort
but
of
now
classic
far
word.
More, but far more people are actually homeless, aren't they? We've got 200,000 in the country homeless. That's people who are living in severely overcrowded accommodation or sleeping on the streets or otherwise homeless.
Absolutely.
We've got around about 20,000 in Bristol, even though the council don't admit it. I wrinkled out some figures. It's nearly 20,000 people actually on the housing register. If you wanted to do a mail shot to all the housing people, all the homeless people in Bristol, and you went to Bristol City Council and paid them to make that mail shot, they'd be going to 20,000 people.
Interesting, because Bristol City Council officially counts maybe at the top max 11 people sleeping
rough. Yeah. But this is the people on the housing register and coming to the council asking for anyway.
Council are saying that we are homeless. I'd like to make a homelessness application. Yes, you're right. That list is much longer. And going back to the 80s, well, I remember that too, that suddenly I remember I was in London at the time seeing people, young people, that was very unusual, begging, that everything changed under that government. And that's how I feel what's happening now, that things have got worse. And apparently in 2010, the homeless figures were beginning to decline and now they're shooting up again. Again, we're under a very unkind, harsh government.
That's
It's
a bit cruel, isn't it? There's a lot more people. Victorian, a lot of
it's
people are saying
Victorian.
That.
There's the deserving poor, the undeserving poor. I mean, this is one of the richest countries in the world. For me, it's hard to understand.
Well, you mentioned Victorian, but just look at the Eton uniforms.
That's right, Michael. You were sharing with us some of your experiences when you first arrived at Bristol Foundation Housing Hostel, one of the hostels. Can you tell us how you settled in and, you know, how you found it over the first few months?
Well, I think, first of all, there was an overwhelming sense of relief. The fact that I wasn't faced with, you know, sleeping on the streets, which I must admit, at one point I thought it was going to happen. So there was that relief. And also, within my first week, Bristol Foundation Housing staff, they gave me basically a week to settle in and sort of find my feet in the area, because I didn't know Bedminster at all well. And then after that week, we had our sort of initial support session, and that's when they started identifying my support needs, various challenges to sort of, you know, moving on, and how best to go about them, but not in a pressurizing way at all, not in terms of we need to fill this paperwork out now, more in terms of, you know, we want to help you. And that's been an ongoing process. So, like I say, it was something quite different for me, because I'd never been in this sort of circumstance before. But they made me feel, I think welcome's probably the wrong word, but I felt quite well settled.
So were you living on top of other people? How did you find that?
I was actually quite lucky with the room I was allocated. It's in a rather secluded part of the building. So, but it's quite a nice building, I must say. And I wouldn't say that you're living on top of other people. You know, everyone's got their own separate rooms, obviously. I think the biggest ratio in terms of shared bathrooms is, I think there's maybe 3 rooms to 1 bathroom. There's a very large shared kitchen and a lounge. There's an office there with a computer that, when staff aren't using it, you know, if you need to check your email or anything like that, residents are able to. And that also helps for things like bidding on Home Choice, which, of course, you can only do electronically now. So, yeah, it's a great service, I think.
Now, this might be an awkward question to answer, but if Bristol Foundation Housing hadn't been there for you, I mean, you said you were possibly would have been sleeping on the streets. How would you have dealt with that, or would you have been able to deal with it?
Given my emotional state at the time, I would not have been able to deal with it. I don't even want to think about what would have happened, but it wouldn't have been a very pretty place for me.
Elizabeth, sounds like it's a very important service that's been provided here. But the council, of course, will say that you haven't filled out the paperwork correctly at Bristol Foundation Housing. They've got their reasons, haven't they?
Yes, I'd like to know more about their reasons. And one of the things that the residents have been asking for is to sit round and to have a negotiation with the council, because the council seems to be set against, for some reason, mysterious reason, we'd really like to know, this particular model, this Bristol Foundation Housing. I would like to say also, when Michael was talking, it made me think that, you know, the way you were talking about the unpressured way that unpressured approach. And I think this is what's unique about Bristol Foundation Housing, is that it's not outcome driven. So much of our services, sadly, is outcome driven.
When you say that, what do you mean by outcome driven?
Well, I guess that because people have to show, look, we thank you for this money, government, that you've given us. This is what we've managed to do with the money.
Well, for example, like what?
Which is fair enough in one sense. Of course, you have to be accountable. But some service providers, for instance, will not take a certain group of challenging, vulnerable people because they know they won't get the outcomes. So therefore, this vulnerable, chaotic, I don't want to use bad, rude words, but, you know, a group of people that may be really struggling and may be aggressive and may be bashing up things, they're not going to be welcomed by some providers because you won't get great outcomes. That's what I mean. So Bristol Foundation Housing actually will take in people who might take a long time to settle down. That Bristol Foundation Housing actually want to give people a stable base to take the fear out of their lives so they can make their own choices.
So, I mean, have the council actually scrutinised exactly what you're doing? Have they done any sort of reports, reviews? Have they shared them with you?
Well, this is interesting. Well, there's two things to say about this. Michael and I attended a scrutiny committee at the council a few weeks ago, and we were told afterwards, actually, by one of the councillors, helpfully, that this scrutiny committee has been scrutinising the charity, but had not shared any of this with the charity. So the charity is feeling, hold on a minute, I don't understand why Bristol City Council doesn't welcome us with open arms. Surely they should be very happy that we're doing the service. But instead there's been this kind of resistance, this kind of hostile atmosphere. So I feel there needs to be the charity is actually saying, well, scrutinise us. You know, let's have this open, transparent discussion about what is it that you don't like about our services. I mean, I can speculate all sorts of things, like, you know, you can cut, but we don't know for sure.
Well, one of the things that, because I actually had a text exchange with George Ferguson about Bristol Foundation Housing. And one of the things that when he texted me back, he said, actually, it's costing too much, because I know that for ordinary housing benefit, which is paid for people's rent, one of the things that Bristol Foundation Housing does is it takes a bit more, because you're providing as a specific type of housing provider, you're providing a bit more of a service than just a roof over someone's head.
Absolutely. Yes. So the type of funding that was specifically chosen by the charity is called exempt accommodation. And this is
exempt from what? Do you know what that means?
Well, it's actually exempt from housing benefit changes to the law.
Okay.
That's why it's called exempt. It was exempt. Some changes were made to the housing benefit law, but this category was left unchanged. It was exempt because it was specifically for vulnerable people, with recognition that in order to help people maintain their housing, they needed some support and basic support, like helping people maintain their housing by attending certain appointments or maybe helping them with food and quite sort of basic support things, but when you're struggling, could be very useful.
Okay, so how's the negotiations gone with the council? You've obviously been along to this scrutiny committee. Have you found them fairly open? I mean, well, they obviously are public servants. We pay their wages, we pay our council tax, and they should be as open as possible. Have you found them so?
I feel frustrated because we don't quite get the sort of discussion that I would like. It doesn't feel like an open discussion. I think part of... You mentioned about a review. You mentioned perhaps that's something worth talking about, that review. You know, you asked, had there been any kind of council...
Well, one would hope that there's some sort of dialogue in a situation like this. That's the way to sort things out.
Yeah, so Bristol City Council based its decision to cut 79% of the funding on a review, which I think can I pass on to Michael to talk about?
Yeah, of course, Michael, yeah.
Yeah,
the review was held, let me just get my date straight here, it was towards the beginning of this year, and it was carried out by a group called Supporting People, and they went around to the various different properties of BFH. And spoke to various residents, asking them various questions about, well, theoretically, I understand that their remit was to ask the questions about what levels of support they've been receiving, how they find their accommodation, how they find living with BFH, you know, the general sort of things that anyone reviewing a service would ask a service recipient. If you will.
So this is really a kind of an audit, isn't it? I mean, the council's spending a lot of money on this. Mm. We want to know what we're getting for our bucks, basically.
Essentially, yeah. That I believe was the remit given to supporting people when they did this this review. But I myself wasn't asked to attend an interview with them. I think in my hostel there were, I think, four people asked to attend. One of them, for a start, he made it very clear, is actually a co-founder of the Bristol Foundation Homeless Residents Association, Josh Evans. He was interviewed by these people, and he was asked questions about the operation of BFH, the company, and how they work, and, you know, questions that he, as a service recipient, A, has no reason to know, and B, shouldn't be put in a position to have to respond to these sort of questions. There were also other cases where apparently, obviously I wasn't there at the time, but apparently people were told that if they gave, say, a damning view of Bristol Foundation Housing, it would help them because the council would then be obliged to give them a council flat.
Oh, so that's an interesting thing. But this is, we have to stress here, this is just rumours about the council interview techniques. But do you agree that it's actually important for the council to do this? Because this is public money that's going to pay for your housing.
I totally agree. I think, as you said, it's public money. We all, even though I'm on my on benefits, you know, I still make the contributions. And when I was working, everyone's paying for, you know, the great social state, and it's brilliant that these services are there. And so, of course, any public money that's spent should be accounted for. But I think we have real issues with the way that the review was conducted, and also the criteria that the council used to measure. I think they said about 80% of residents did not qualify for the enhanced benefit or the exempt benefit, and that's really why we started this whole dialogue, or tried to start this dialogue with the council, is to work out, okay, exactly what are these criteria, and how can you say that 90%, 80% of the residents don't meet these criteria.
So, Elizabeth, are you wondering whether the council are actually thinking about the way that this organisation is run is what they don't like? It sounds to me, from Michael, that that's one of the things that they were interested in, is the management of Bristol Foundation Housing, and that possibly that they felt that was what was the problem here.
It's really hard to speculate. I mean, I can speculate till the
cars
come home.
Yeah,
we are speculating.
Because it's very difficult to know why they were threatened to do it to something so important.
Absolutely, which is why we really need this dialogue. We really need a grown-up discussion. I think that would be fantastic.
I mean, have you managed to speak to the housing director at Bristol City Council?
We did have a meeting, not the housing director, we had a meeting with Nick Hooper, who was, I believe, head of the department. I didn't feel that we quite got to the sort of bottom of things. One thing in that meeting, though, we were handed a press release from 2011, which stated that Bristol City Council does not like exempt accommodation, does not like this form of public funding.
Well, I'll tell you why that is, because it's quite expensive.
Yes, from Bristol City Council's point of view, as they experience it, it's uncapped. Although, having said that, you do have to set a reasonable. You can't just ask for all the money in the world and say that's it. Give me, you know, you have to make a reasonable, and you have to have an argument for why you're asking
you
for so
amount.
Much.
Yeah, well,
exactly.
I understand that. So what's the situation now then? I mean, are we looking at the possible ability of closure? Because obviously the amount of money coming in has gone down. You've still got the residents. How are you managing to cope right now?
Well, I mean, some people are it's a bit dire, actually.
There's a psychological effect, isn't there, on the staff? The fact that potentially things could be starting to crumble. That has a dreadful effect on people's ability to carry on and do their job, which is a very important job that they're doing. But what about the actual, you know, have the city council actually put the organisation into the state where they might have to actually close down? Well, what's the situation?
Well, the situation is that in reality, that out of those 9 hostels, 7 will have to close. I think that's about the figure. Well, they're in the process, sadly, of closing now.
So what's happening to the people? Maybe you know a bit more about this, Michael. The people who are residents at Bristol Foundation Housing, where are they going? And what's happening with you, for example?
Well, at the moment, I haven't been told that I need to leave, which is great. But sort of you get that sinking feeling every morning when you wake up thinking, is this going to be the day? I can't really speak for other people, but I think BFH, with the best intentions, if there are people that they do have to let go, they will try and signpost them on to other services, other housing providers. They'll help them, obviously, if they're not on Home Choice already, you know, that sort of thing, sort of support them as much as they can. But unfortunately, they at some point, they will just have to say, sorry, we no longer have the... bed space is the wrong term, but the capacity.
Now, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago when Bristol City Council went over to Home Choice, I was chosen for some reason to be part of the consultation, which was part of the changeover, because in the old days there was a housing list, everybody filled in a housing form, and say, for example, your housing situation got worse, you might shift to the top of the list and then be housed and get a letter. And the onus was on the council to house you. You were on the list, but nowadays with this Home Choice system on a computer, it's very, very different. You've actually got to be quite smart to use that system and to get housed. Mm. Now, it seems to me actually completely illogical to do that, because you've got the most vulnerable people who are having the onus is on them to get themselves housed. Now, I would have thought the only people getting housed now are those who are very good on a computer. Elizabeth, where are we going to go from here? Because it looks like things are closing down. Is there anywhere for people to go from Bristol Foundation Housing?
Well, that's a really good question, and that is the key question. What will happen to the people who are potentially made homeless again? Where are the homes? Where are the places?
I mean, obviously, with places closing, some people will have had to find accommodation. What's happened so far with that?
Yes, okay. I don't know. I really can't comment on specifics on where people have gone.
What about you, Michael? Any idea?
Well, I can think of two cases, both personal friends of mine. Both of them moved on, actually, independently. One of the gentlemen, he actually moved on to an almshouse in Hotwells. Now, that building is now suddenly being faced with closure, so he's essentially back in the same predicament. It is for different reasons. It's not a council, it's a thing. I believe it's a privately funded enterprise. Another friend of mine was lucky enough to secure a place on his own with a little bit of help, financial help from others. But of course, not everyone is lucky enough to either be able to approach another charity and have them accept you, or to be able to secure private funding, if you will, for example.
I mean, you're talking about hundreds of pounds as a deposit to even start, before you start.
Exactly.
Looking,
well, I mean, yeah, because basically you're looking at your initial deposit. Most places, if they want your first month's rent up front, that is a huge amount of money for people that I think are mainly on about £140 a fortnight.
But Michael, what will you do if that message does come tomorrow? Sorry, you're going to have to move out. What will you do?
Go back to bed. Wake up thinking about it again. I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know. I think I would have to... Well, I would have to take my eviction notice down to the council house. Not the council, the council officers. And say to them that I've been given my 28-day notice to quit. What can you do to help me?
Well, let's hope they can find you somewhere, because you're going to be there in the queue with another 15,000 people at least. Elizabeth, where's your campaign to try and keep these places open going from here?
Well, the main thing is to raise awareness right now. What we'd like to do is reinstate the payments while negotiations are taking place. To me, that seems like the sensible grown-up thing to do. You know, the hostels exist, the places exist, the support exists, there's dedicated staff. Reinstate the payments, and then let's sort out what the situation is. It has happened in other local authorities, where Bristol Foundation Housing has other places, where the people can sit round the table. And
that's amazing. So yeah. Not just in, even your Bristol Foundation Housing, you're not just in Bristol.
No,
give us some examples of other places then.
There are other local authorities.
I believe North Somerset and South Gloucestershire.
And Derbyshire.
And Derbyshire, they, crikey.
I know, Derbyshire.
That's quite a distance from Bristol, isn't it?
Yeah.
So things are working okay there,
yes.
But just not here.
Yes,
so the whole thing
right.
sounds very strange.
Well, it does seem to have a very different approach, which is hard to... And the other interesting thing about what makes Bristol City Council different from some other local authorities is that Bristol City Council used to have a policy of if you made a homelessness application, if I went to Bristol City Council and said I'm homeless, that I would be assessed. Is this person homeless or are they not? But instead, Bristol City Council signposts people, before assessing whether they're homeless or not, it will send them off to another service like Bristol Foundation Housing. And then, or it may well make assess that person and find that they're not homeless, or find that they don't have high priority needs. So the system within Bristol is really, I suppose you could say, turning a blind eye. It's not seeing the extent of the problem. So that means that if you're working within the system, you don't have to quite see what's going on.
Strange. I can remember there used to be a place called The Hub, didn't there? I think it's, I'm trying to remember the name of the street. It's behind the Holiday Inn on the Bear Pit. There's a little street round there where there's a place called The Hub, which anyone who's having problems with their housing in the city went to. That then was closed, and all these signs everywhere around the city still up there pointing to this place. You imagine if someone was homeless, following the signs and then finding this boarded up building. And then that itself was squatted. The actual building where the homeless offices had been was squatted. I think there were some squatters in there for about a month or so, very happy, actually looking after the place. And it was being used as a way for, if people actually did turn up, they could give them some advice about the legalities of squatting. Hand out squatters' handbooks, for example, which is a nice little thing you can buy for £1 if you need to get to know what the law is on squatting. Then what happened? Of course, that was evicted, and now that entire street is boarded up, which just seems such a crying shame. Michael, what's your thought about, because there's so many empty offices, so many boarded up buildings, and yet people desperate for somewhere to live.
Yeah, I think it makes very little sense. I mean, any landlord with huge tracts of land, any landlord with a large square meterage of office space obviously wants to get business in there, because obviously all the cabling, from a technical point of view, all the cabling is already laid and the lighting and everything like that, so minimal expense. To turn that into residential properties, it's going to take a lot of money for them. So I can, in one hand, I can understand why a lot of these empty business premises are left empty, but at the same time, it just does not make sense. When you think all of this free space, and 15,000 was the figure that you mentioned in Bristol? Homeless?
Yes, around, well, that's the official figure. I believe the figure is more like 19,000-20,000, but that's the official figure, is 14,500-15,000 people on the homelessness register wanting some help with their housing from the city council, whether that's being overcrowded or actually street homeless. So that's the number of people. Elizabeth, what are your thoughts about this thing about the lack of offices being actually occupied and used, buildings being used?
I find it obscene. I feel we live in quite a sick society, that we have people who do not have a roof over their heads, and we have practically empty offices. And we know, I think the financial system is not helpful, in the sense that from a business point of view, if you have it from the business person's point of view, you know, having an office sitting there is a useful tax.
It's an investment, isn't it?
Exactly,
I mean, a lot of people have got their money in the stock exchange, and they decided, well, I think the stock exchange is a little bit iffy at the moment, so they'll put it into a building. Now, this is the problem for me, is that I don't think buildings should be just an investment for an individual or for a person. That is something that the reason that I often will keep them empty and not rent them out is because they can sell them very quickly and easily when they're empty. If you've got people inside there, it can take months, if not years, to actually sell your building. So the idea is they would like their buildings that they've invested in to be like cash in the bank that they can get rid of and sell and swap at any time. And that's one of the reasons I think we've got so many. And the other thing is there's a lot of business rate relief. You can get business rate relief quite a lot so that you can have a this is almost advertising the idea of buying up properties and leaving them empty, but you can do that and then not have to pay anything in terms of taxes for having that massive empty building, which I just think is a terrible crying shame. So I've got off the subject, I'm afraid, Foundation Housing, but looking at the wider picture of homelessness in the city.
And actually, I was talking about the founder, Martin Connolly. I mean, in the 80s, that was exactly, he hated the idea of that homes were not homes. They were seen, exactly as you said, as investments. This is, we've lost the human need. We've forgotten about what humans need to exist in a safe way, which is they need shelter. It's very simple.
We talked about the Victorian business right at the start, didn't we? You know, that's a scary road to go down, because let's think about the way the Irish were treated by the Victorians, for example, you know, the Irish famines and things like that. I mean, this is they were very cruel to the very poorest because they wanted cheap labour, and they were treating people almost like animals, appallingly. And we've come a long way from there, for goodness sake. So anyway, good luck with your campaign to keep at least some of these places open. And you've got an exhibition, haven't you?
Yeah, I'd like to say, on behalf of the residents, we've organised an exhibition at Hamilton House on Stokes Croft, which will be the last day open to the public is the 5th of November, Tuesday the 5th. And it's called, and it's based on the words that one of our residents said. The title is Without a Home, the Night is Long. And it's got photographs by Ian Usher, who's a photographer artist, but the words are coming from the residents and the workers themselves.
Okay, so exactly where and when is that exhibition on?
So it will have been on since Thursday, and it finishes on Tuesday the 5th of November. It's free. You just wander into Hamilton House, which is 80 Stokes Croft.
You can't miss it, really, can you? It's such a hubbub of activity.
That's right. And you just wander in, and you wander into reception on your left, and there it is.
And if you're not quite sure where it is, just ask for the canteen. You'll find it. Michael, finally...
people can... And there'll be a petition there for people to sign, and there's also a petition online. In fact, there's a Facebook page with the initials of... So it's... Do you want to say it?
BFHRA. That's the
BFHRA.
Yep. Bristol Foundation Homeless Residents Association. Bit of a mouthful.
Michael, just to round off, I'd just like you to give us in a nutshell your why you think that it's important to save Bristol Foundation Housing.
Because of the level of support and services that they offer for people that need them when they're in a really, really difficult time in their lives.
So, Elizabeth Winkler, campaigning for Bristol Foundation Housing, and Michael Phelps, one of the residents, still just...
Just.
Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
And now I'm joined by Jason Yiannakopoulos for our weekly look around the week's news. Jason, you're clutching your eye newspaper, your 20p hit for news. Do you think it's worth it? I mean, actually, in London, they give out, and of course, the Metro is free, isn't it? Is it worth 20p to get the eye or what?
Yeah, well, it is pretty good newspaper. I will point out I've also got the Metro with me.
Covering both sides there. Right. Anyway, energy bills. Labour, it seems, are doing quite well out of Ed Miliband picking up on this issue and saying that they're going to freeze energy prices. Everybody now seems to be talking about energy bills, don't they?
They do, and it's perhaps overwhelming about Labour. They've gone up 4 points on the Conservatives on that in the latest poll.
So he's kind of leading the debate. Maybe he's actually leading the country from the other side of the House of Commons.
Well, that debate. I mean,
he's looking more like a leader. Do you think that's fair?
He's starting to look more like a leader, and it is, and it is a great idea. It really is.
Why do you say that? Why is it so important, the energy bills issue?
Oh, because it went up quite a bit, and there's growing anger over a spate of recent energy price hikes. Particularly by the big six energy firms.
But David Cameron said he wants to bring them down too. It's just he's going to use a different way, which is by getting rid of these so-called green taxes, the green cost. It's a little bit extra on your bill, basically, for a kind of green energy tax.
Yeah, that's a way of saying that we shouldn't protect the environment, and that's not really the way to be looking at it.
Okay. I mean, the big energy giants, I mean, also... HMRC this week that's Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, that's the tax man to you and I, have been talking about the big names, that is, I imagine, includes some of these big energy companies. They're saying the government is now saying, or parts of it, I suppose this is Parliament, that some of these companies, the bigger they are, the easier it is for them to avoid tax. And HMRC, the tax man, is really not taking these big companies seriously, and they're going for the low-hanging fruit, I suppose, which is us, you know, ordinary individuals. It's easy to get money off of them, but these massive companies, they've got lawyers and lawyers behind them. So what's going on there? Which big names are the HMRC ignoring?
Senior tax officials were criticised by MPs yesterday because their estimate of £35 billion lost every year in unpaid tax is the tip of the iceberg. It does not include the use of any legal avoidance schemes, such as ones most recently reported in various papers, including the Eye. Officials from Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs were interrogated by the Committee of Public Accounts at a hearing in Westminster over the failure to claw back tax from big business.
Did it actually name any of these companies which they're not taxing enough?
So it was a joint investigation between the Eye and Corporate Watch revealed last week that more than 30 companies, including major high street chains, the Channel Tunnel, Railink and Camelot, are using tax avoidance schemes by which the UK companies load up with debt from their overseas owners and use the interest to slash their taxable UK income.
Okay, so basically they're just swapping things around, different lines on the balance sheet again. Any of the actual high street companies named in the report, Jason? Because it's always nice to know who it is that's doing these little tax dodges.
Unfortunately, not in this particular article, which is a shame. Yeah, unfortunately, the Eye doesn't actually name any of the companies.
Okay, well, never mind. HMRC, anyhow, are not really paying enough attention to the big... It seems like the bigger you are, the easier it is to dodge tax and get away with things. Okay, next story is about this Bristol man. It's Bijan Abrahimi from Brislington, isn't it?
It says here that it saved a man who was badly beaten to death and set alight... after being wrongly accused of paedophilia, after he was spotted taking photos of children who were believed to be vandalising his blooming flowers.
Well, the awful thing about this, of course, is that he was actually arrested. Rather than the police looking at the circumstances and going and finding the people who'd been vandalising the allotment, he was actually arrested himself and then afterwards killed. A really horrendous incident. And I see that it's awful, isn't it, when Bristol hits the headlines round the nation because of an incident like this. And I think look as if, I mean, these police, some of them are facing disciplinary proceedings, but it does look as if perhaps they were a little bit jumpy and arrested the wrong people here, and that has had awful consequences. At least that's the way things certainly look.
It does point out here that Bristol City Council has launched its own inquiry.
I should think so too. Good, and the police are also, of course, someone has actually confessed to the murder, and so that court case will be coming up fairly soon. Okay, so what more does the report say about that?
It named the two people. I don't know.
Yeah, yes, go for it. Yeah,
it's, the two people are Stephen Norley and Lee James. Lee James lived two doors away from Mr. Abrahimi with his young family, and him and next door neighbour Steve Norley, who one of them lived the other side, dragged the body from the council home, set it alight. They have admitted to murder. Well, Lee James admitted to murder. Steve Norley has admitted to assisting an offender. And they'll be sentenced at Bristol Crown Court tomorrow.
Okay, so that's this week anyway. So I suppose the lesson to be learnt from this one is pretty simple, isn't it? Don't go on rumours. Make sure you get your facts straight. And, I mean, there's obviously a potential element of racism in here. Horrible to see this kind of thing, and we must stamp that out right across the city.
It's also disabled, isn't it? I would add as well.
Yeah. Okay, so a bit of a lighter note. Cheddar Gorge is in the news. Great, isn't it? Also another, whenever we see local places that are in the national news, I love it.
Yeah, this one's a really odd, but at the same time, incredibly funny story. Basically, the Lord Bath and the National Trust they're having a huge argument over what to do with Cheddar Gorge. The idea of this particular one is that Lord Bath wants to install a cable car over the gorge, and National Trust are objecting to this.
Well, what do you think? Do you think, I mean, is that okay to do that sort of thing? I mean, it's going to give you a nice view of the gorge, isn't it, the cable car?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that Lord Bath and his son, the Viscount Weymouth, they own the southern side of the gorge, which includes the world-famous caves and most of the commercial element, whereas National Trust owns the north side of the gorge.
I suppose if you're going to go across the gorge, it's going to be on the north side. So, and the nice thing about the National Trust is they are actually able to stand up to these people. I know in law, they have a very good, strong case in planning, don't they? The National Trust can block things. Like, say, for example, a bypass is going through National Trust land. Now, whoever wants to build that bypass has basically got to get down on their hands and knees and beg. They're never going to get planning permission unless the National Trust let them. So I would suggest what's going on here is Lord Bath is trying to make a few bob. And, I mean, if you've been to Cheddar recently, it's looking quite derelict. Quite a lot of the buildings are boarded up in Cheddar. Maybe there's not enough money to be made down in the village and the sort of tourist attractions, and Lord Bath is trying to steal a march on most of Cheddar and attract the tourists elsewhere.
Well, yeah, Lord Bath is the owner of Longleat House, which is by Cheddar Gorge.
Well, it's quite away from Cheddar Gorge, Longleat.
Marquess of Bath. This is. I love the way that Helen Bonza Wilson, the Assistant Director of Operations at National Trust, came up with a wonderful quote here. This is the equivalent of trying to build a cable car in front of Buckingham Palace.
Well, let's see if they get away with it. That's an interesting one. All right, Jason, thanks very much. We'll speak to you again next week.
Thank you, Tony.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Including Jeff. Jeff Sparks is here with our What's On Guide.
Thank you, Tony. This is What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 1st of November, the UK's longest-running and biggest Guns N' Roses tribute in history, Guns to Roses, will be performing with the most authentic Metallica tribute in the UK, Metallica Reloaded, at the Beer Keller in All Saints Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Into Song of the Week, I present Guns N' Roses. This group formed in 1985 in Los Angeles, USA, and in their career have released 6 studio albums, 1 live album, 1 compilation album and several singles. This song is from the album Lies, which was released in 1988 and is titled Patience.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Cause I'm missing you, I'm still alright to smile. Girl, I think about you every day now. Was a time when I wasn't sure, but you set my mind at ease. There is no doubt you're in my heart now. Said, woman, take it slow, it'll work itself out fine. All we need is just a little patience. Said, sugar, make it slow, when we come together fine. All we need is just a little patience. Sit here on the stairs, 'cause I'd rather be alone. If I can't have you right now, I'll wait, dear. Sometimes I get so tense, but I can't speed up the time. But you know, love, there's one more thing to consider. Woman, take it slow, things will be just fine. You and I'll just use a little patience. Said sugar, take the time, 'cause the lights are shining bright. You and I've got what it takes to make it. Won't break it. Oh, I'll never break it, 'cause I can't take it.
That was Guns N' Roses with Patience from the album Lies, which was released in 1988. Moving into Saturday, 2nd of November, the Godfathers will be performing with support from the Hot 27s and the Lone Sharks at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 3rd of November, Hawkwind will be performing the entire album, Warrior on the Edge of Time, at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £20 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Wow, sounds fantastic. Warrior on the Edge, Jeff, you going to be down there?
No, I won't be down there for that one.
Oh, come on.
No, I'll be at the Guns N' Roses, Guns to Roses one instead.
We could do a little boogie together.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, well, Jeff Sparks and with your What's On Guide, and Guns N' Roses still tinkling away in the background there. Thanks very much. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Elizabeth Winkler and Michael Phelps from Bristol Foundation Housing, as well as Jason Yannakopoulos for the news review and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733. You'll find them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And also, here's the number for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Bye for now.
Belongs in the hands of people.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Bad.
They're crazy, 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 crazy.
10 seconds to commercial.
Sometimes extreme behavior can be the warning sign of a mental illness. Learn to see the sickness.
The President of the United States!
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The sickness.
Regrettably,
bloodshed.
We now believe
strife.
that only force will make him lead.
Right. I am certain our cause is just,
a gallon of gas.
And I am certain our cause is moral,
loss of life.
And I am certain our cause is right.
Give me the goddamn money. A new world order.
I don't know.
It's going to be all right tonight.
Lying.
Again.
I'm from the United States of Kiss My Ass.
Stupidity.
Again.
Demonstrations of this kind are demoralizing the whole country.
Corruption. Again.
Don't hate the media. Become the media.
Power. It's up to you.
Choice.
It's up to you.
Change the world.
It's up to you.
Please do your part.
What the truth is.
Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park.
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The protesters are a tiny but vocal minority. The American people overwhelmingly support the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, how do you feel?
Bum, you get a job.
Kids we've sent out into the world.